of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, blasphemous and outright wrong. French Interior Minister Gérard Damanin has warned there will be more attacks as the country is placed on maximum security alert following Thursday's deadly attack by a knife-wielding man who killed three people at the Basilica of Notre Dame in the southern city of Nice. France's maximum security alert level means repressive measures will be carried out, such as arrests without court warrants, police raids on premises, and the blocking of websites with anti-establishment material. French President Emmanuel Macron, who has called the deadly stabbing a terrorist attack, announced that there will be increased surveillance of churches and military patrols on the streets of France. Troops guarding the streets have been bolstered in number. One could say this is discriminatory and a violation of human rights. No doubt, if it was another country putting troops on the streets and marking warrantless arrests to stop anti-establishment protests, the West would rally against it. For France, however, these measures come too late for those who have already lost their lives due to terrorism and Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam rhetoric and policies. France did the same thing when it helped the United States invade Iraq on the pretext of destroying Saddam's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. As such, France knew the claims were geopolitically motivated, but it did send troops to Iraq to take part in one of the greatest human rights atrocities of this century. In sending troops to kill the Muslim population and get away with human rights violations and crimes against humanity in the name of bogus war on terror. What is going on in France is in fact similar method to what the French did employ in Iraq. Take for example, French troops are placed on the streets of Paris and Nice after protests linked to the publication of cartoons and Emmanuel Macron's hate speech on the pretext of freedom of speech. The terrorist attacks that have taken place in France, whilst tragic, are a drop in the ocean compared to the thousands of state-sponsored terror attacks and bombings that take place in Iraq, Syria and Yemen on the pretext of democracy building and war on terror. The fact is, a Muslim person's life is just as valuable as a French person's life, and the Muslim governments have just as much responsibility to protect their citizens as the French government has to protect its citizens. Thanks to the bogus war on terror by the United States and its duped allies, including France, the endless war has set up education centers for terrorism, and Wahhabism is not just in West Asia region, but in Europe. This is no different to France, which in 2016 opened its first de-radicalization center in Pontourny for its own young people returning from Syria. Originally, the French government, who believed that over 9,000 people in France had been radicalized in Syria, planned to house many at these centers, known as Centers for Prevention, Integration and Citizenship, to complete a 10-month curriculum. However, in France, the centers, which were voluntary, had been a disaster because few were attended these centers. The fact is, those who slice off innocent heads in churches and the US-led government that who butchered citizens in Iraq, Syria and Yemen in the name of freedom of democracy believe their actions are justified. As such, they do not believe they are morally responsible under international laws. This means they will not voluntarily attend a course to change their views, nor will they ever end their endless war on terror in the West Asia region. France has been involved in a number of illegal invasions and interventions that feed terrorism in both France and elsewhere in Europe. France also took part in invasion of Afghanistan, whose destabilization has played a prominent role in radicalizing many Afghans. France, along with the United Kingdom, led the charge in destruction of Libya. It was French President Nicolas Sarkozy at the time who made it his mission to gather an international coalition to wage war on Libya. France is also engulfed in the mess that is Syria. While being against President Bashar al-Assad, France has simultaneously bombed civilian targets in Syria. France's foreign wars and interventions have destabilized West Asia region and Europe. This has led to refugees pouring into Europe, which has in turn undermined the stability of the European countries. The atrocities in Iraq, the atrocities in Afghanistan, in Libya and Syria are human rights disasters that are unmatched and unprecedented. France brought universal damnation upon itself.
Iran Today.
Iran and America, once fast friends, turned foe 40 plus years ago with Iran's Islamic Revolution of 1979. But were they ever friends? Platonic friends on a par, that is. Iranians remember no less than some 60 years of bilateral underlying enmity, beginning with U.S. bullying.
How can you beat a bully? You can't very well be a bigger bully than the biggest, even if you want to. And that's partly why Iran was pulled towards an anti-imperialist revolution, and till today has resistance at the top of its agenda. But what made Iranians suspect America all those years ago before the revolution? And can a Democrat such as Biden make a difference all these decades later? To unlock closed doors and open a path for talks between Iran and the U.S. I'm Leila Faramayzi in Iran Today.
A day particularly marked in bad blood between Iran and the U.S. is the 4th of November, or 13th of Aban on the Iranian calendar. This year it coincided with the 3rd of November, but it has been no less eventful. It is still the anniversary of Students' Day and the U.S. Embassy takeover in Iran. And in the U.S., it's marked Election Day, after debates between a highly controversial Republican and a level-headed Democrat. Mr. Sadatian is a U.S.-Iran affairs expert. It was a pleasure to hear him at Press TV Studios.
Iranians have never fully trusted the U.S. and its policies, even before the revolution. Why so?
Pessimism vis-a-vis the U.S. is mainly rooted in the 1953 coup against the Mossadegh government. Until that event, or up to World War II, the U.S. was not much involved in colonialism, I mean externally, as it had realized colonialist projects internally. But after that, it gradually found a black image in the countries where it interfered. The Iran issue is a case in point, as the Americans were duped by the Britons into getting involved with the 1953 coup. Many related events followed, including Nixon's visit to Tehran and the death of Iranian students. That, along with similar incidents, made Iranians pessimistic about the Americans.
I've also another U.S.-Iran expert here with the right brain cells for a logical analysis of interstate relations. That would be Mr. Abolfat.
The Islamic Republic of Iran took great strides to reach an understanding. It even ignored its demands in order to reach a win-win deal. But the Americans broke their pledges, as the Europeans have acknowledged it. Furthermore, the atmosphere of mutual confidence built at that time was damaged, while it could extend to non-nuclear issues too. Therefore, the Islamic Republic of Iran had no other option than resistance. It was Iran's sole choice, particularly after Mr. Trump came to power. Maximum resistance against maximum pressure.
November the 4th, 1979 is a symbol of the confrontations between two forces in the history of the Islamic Republic. The founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, was exiled to Turkey on November the 4th, 1964, for protesting the Shah's affiliations. Dozens of Iranian students were killed on November the 4th, 1978, before the revolution, in protest to U.S. affiliations at home. And finally, the capture of the U.S. embassy was on November the 4th, 1979, year of the revolution. This was the end of the counter-revolutionary actions of the embassy in Iran. When Imam Khomeini was faced with the action, he referred to the embassy takeover as the Second Revolution. The celebration of this day, Students' Day, is a celebration of the efforts of a country that has aspired to stand against the desired order of a superpower. Interestingly, Donald Trump also chose the same day in 2018 to reinstate sanctions on Iran.
The Americans maintain that Iran disrupts any order. The U.S. is a superpower and has spent $8 trillion realizing their regional ambitions. Thousands of U.S. servicemen have died in the Afghanistan and Iraq wars in order to restore order. The Americans say Iran complied with the world order up to 1979, but it turned to revolutionism afterwards.
Referring to his opponent, Biden, on the question of whether level heads might think for themselves henceforth or continue to be guided by policies set by their predecessors, as has been the case with U.S. presidential successions, our next guest says, let's see what Mr. Ocalanlu has to say. He's editor-in-chief of the political magazine Musallas.
It would be both correct to say it would make a difference or would make a difference. You may ask why. It's because of political psychology, policy making, international relations. That would make people and parties different from one another. A case in point is the difference between Obama and Bush Jr. So what's the case with Bush Sr. and Bush Jr., Mitt Romney, Colin Powell or McCain would be totally different from Trump, were they elected president? However, they are the same regarding the Americans' objective of containing Iran and causing the country to change its behavior.
Democratic presidents of the United States have evidently not refrained from any blows against Iran. The string of sanctions Iran's post-revolution history has been decorated with were colorfully named by Republicans and Democrats alike. Executive sanctions against Iran began with Democrat Jimmy Carter. Clinton later took important steps to hit the Iranian economy with his unprecedented sanctions. The Obama administration, especially Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, was at the forefront of all U.S. administration sanctions against the Iranian people with painful sanctions. Suffice to look at her book, Hard Choices, and see how she committed herself to cutting off Iran's oil, or lifeblood. She made every effort to build an international consensus against Iran.
Would it make any difference to Iran if a Democrat such as Biden got in, or a Republican such as Trump?
Donald Trump and Joe Biden could not be viewed as totally different. Both may create opportunities and threats for the Islamic Republic of Iran. We cannot say Biden is good and Trump is bad. If Biden comes into power, he would create both opportunities and threats for Iran. So is the case with Trump. If he's re-elected, the current sanctions will continue to remain in effect. However, Trump would also create some opportunities for Iran without really meaning it. Therefore, we cannot say this one is good and that one is bad.
We must not forget that in the 8 years of Obama's presidency, Joe Biden was the first vice president. In fact, the sanctions Trump reinstated against Iran were mostly imposed by the Democratic administration. But with Trump re-elected, things could get a lot uglier than the economic war on Iran, which is sanctions.
We are resisting here while Trump continues to stick with his policy of applying maximum pressure on Iran. That may lead to military confrontation. If it happens, it would create tensions in the region. Some nations are trying to prevent such confrontation, but Trump has shown in practice that he will continue with his policy if he wins the election.
It's a wonder how the U.S. administration has gotten its people to believe the pursuit of Iran and wars on West Asia are worth the trillions of dollars it's spent. Regarding Iran, Mr. Biden will continue the path of trying for talks and playing the sanctions game, according to Mr. Sadatian.
If Mr. Biden is elected, Democrats would opt for multilateralism in regional talks with Iran. But Mr. Trump would resort to bullying and force to impose his own views on the Islamic Republic. But Iran has so far resisted and refused to buckle down.
The U.S. Embassy, 50 years ago, been state-of-the-art telecommunications machines. Speaking of which, people in virtual media networks and different media outlets today have been talking about one presidential candidate over the other. Who would make a better U.S. president, in other words, for solving the crisis between Iran and America? Iranian politicians, however, believe it makes no difference whether a Democrat or Republican are in power in America, because U.S. foreign policymakers don't understand the importance of Iran in the region and try to control it. They still try to control it, and this is a policy shared by Democrats and Republicans. The only difference is mostly in their rhetoric.
Whatever one might say of the Democrats, Republican Trump got to represent the same party that led the United States during the Iraq-Iran war. We do know that Reagan, U.S. president at the time, did not withhold any assistance to Iraq and against the Iranian people. It is now clear that the United States knew at the time about Iraq's chemical arsenal and Saddam's intent to use it, and even knew where the targets were. At the same time, the United States attacked Iranian ships in the Persian Gulf dozens of times.
The U.S.'s foreign policy relies on two pillars, building consensus and stirring intimidation. Some U.S. administrations, like the Trump administration, are focused on intimidation. He believes that the U.S.'s economic power would make the world obey its orders. He doesn't care about the world's reactions. He's assured that foreign companies would not cooperate with Iran. That is the intimidating aspect of U.S. foreign policy. If we assume Biden to be willing to continue Obama's policy, the U.S. would turn to consensus building once more. He will join global coalitions, improve ties with the European Union, and make efforts to satisfy China and Russia.
To the Europeans, the good thing about it is they don't want an absolute breakdown in Iran.
One reason why the Europeans are defending Iran's cause is that if Iran is weakened too much to reach implosion, a power vacuum would be created, which would cause chaos and repeat Iraqi and Syrian scenarios in Iran. The consequences would be very much heavier than earlier thought.
Mr. Salimi Namin is a historian with an interestingly different but convincing understanding of occurrences to what I'd learned before.
We were a nation with empty hands, but we pinned down the Americans. Before the Islamic Revolution, we had no arms. But after this nation strengthened its determination to end the U.S. hegemony, it succeeded. Today we are highly capable. We can overpower the U.S.'s most sophisticated weapons in the region and discredit the U.S. technology. With such a potential, we can naturally resist the U.S. bullying further.
Should the U.S. succeed in taming Iran, would it not be catastrophic for this region? I mean, it doesn't seem to be so obvious to our neighbors, who are actually shaking hands with Israel today.
The U.S. has long focused on two issues in the region, energy security and Israeli security. Relying on these two strategic issues, the U.S. is justifying its presence in the region. Following the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the Americans have felt a threat to the Israeli security on the part of Iran. The Islamic Revolution accelerated the trend of revival of Palestinian ideals. It also revived Muslim dignity and independence. It also offered a new and reasonable interpretation of nationalism and territory.
Going back to the earlier days of the Pahlavi Shah Mohammad Reza, A newly modernized, developing country like Iran would have to choose a side between the Eastern and Western superpowers of the Cold War era. And while the Soviet Union merged nations into its ideological bloc, the U.S. indirectly colonized them with the promise of sharing in economic prosperity. Even if not fairly in an equal partnership with the U.S., sovereign borders would be respected. But our historian here decisively objects to what he sees as a delusion.
When France was to sign an agreement to develop subway stations in Iran, the U.S. ambassador opposed and the agreement was not signed. On the nuclear issue, the Americans were opposed, even to the research plant. You must know that France was giving Iran the technology. It was the Soviet Union that gave Iran the steel technology. The Americans refused to provide us with the steel production technology that was the motor of all industries.
That is not the only reason why many an Iranian has suspected the honesty of U.S. policy for decades before the revolution even. It began with what's known as the 1953 coup that toppled the oil nationalization era Prime Minister Mossadegh. Of the other prominent reasons for Iranian distrust, some are Iran's adoption of the capitulation bill, which went on from October the 13th, 1964 to November the 4th, 1964. It was brief, as it was an intervention both the administration was largely reluctant about and the people were infuriated by. Next is the U.S.'s endeavors to cause the failure of the Islamic Revolution. The highlight would be January the 28th, 1979. After the U.S. realized that Iran's new governing system would not be bent into the ally it had hoped. Third would be the U.S.'s provoking separatism among ethnic groups. We are referring more to 1979 to 1980. However, that's a ploy the U.S. inherited from European powers of past. Fourth would be the U.S.'s issuing of resolutions against Iran and sheltering the Shah or deposed king in 1980 for cancer treatment. I leave the most current reason to return to in a bit.
Before getting back to where we were, I give you Shahrzad for a look at what other media outlets have to say.
Hi, my name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on Iran's successful resistance against the U.S.'s bullying. In an article by the Rusi, we witness Iran and the U.S., the long and arduous diplomatic road. Under severe economic pressure, the Iranian government is not about to collapse. To the contrary, having survived the worst of the U.S.'s maximum pressure attempts, it is showing a certain degree of confidence in its own resilience. Economic pressure is devastating in the long run, but Iran can live with it in the short term. Furthermore, Iran now sees China and Russia as providing it with a border strategic option, a prop to rely on at the UN, and a counterbalance to US and European pressure. It is true that Iran has remained in the JCPOA in the hope of fully restoring it. Still, there is a faction in Tehran, which is quite vocal in the parliament, that wants Iran to leave the JCPOA and even the non-proliferation treaty. Furthermore, even among those who support the JCPOA, there is still significant worry about Biden. Their argument is just as Obama used his popularity with Europe and was more successful than Bush in increasing sanctions on Iran, Biden too can gain European support in isolating Iran. The Financial Tribune reports Tehran will not surrender to American demands. The United States' purpose is to impose its strategies and policies through pressure, but the Iranian nation will never surrender to U.S. demands, a top general said. They want to bring Iran to the negotiating table, and the result of these negotiations has already been determined as Iran's surrender to the U.S., which is never in accordance with our country's morals, Chief of Staff of the Armed Forces Mohammad Bagheri said in a video conference in Tehran. By accepting the JCPOA, Iran compromised with the world and agreed to reduce part of its tasks to enjoy a reduction of sanctions. The whole world admits that Iran adhered to its commitments, but the U.S. non-adherence complicated the affairs, Bagheri said. Iran waited for a year, but then adopted a policy of active resistance, according to the general, by focusing on self-sufficiency. Merit News Agency claims Trump's insult will unite Iranians against U.S. bullying. calling Trump's insults as a sign of anger over the ineffectiveness of U.S. foreign policy, the chairman of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations said, such moves will make Iranians more united in resisting U.S. bullying. Kamal Kharrazi made the remarks in reaction to the recent anti-Iran insults of the U.S. president, adding Trump's insulting words are a sign of his anger and dissatisfaction with the ineffectiveness of sanctions and the failure to achieve U.S. goals against Iran. Not only such ill-mannered behavior will never help the U.S. to achieve its goals, but also it will make Iranian nation more united in the path of resisting U.S. bullying and unilateralism, he said. The U.S. has intended to bring Iran to its knees through imposing new sanctions and redoubled pressure, he said. He added, the main U.S. policy towards Iran is the maximum pressure that the result of which was U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA, reimposition of anti-Iran sanctions, and assassination of General Soleimani. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
The last reason I'm here to give for Iranian suspicion towards America is the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which appeared to be a center for espionage and conspiracy. We're talking the 1960s and 70s. That's what led to the embassy staffers being taken prisoner by students who had stormed the embassy. They were set free 444 days later on January the 21st, 1981. Just hours after President Reagan delivered his inaugural address. This incident may be what cost Jimmy Carter a second term as president. So Iran may complain about the U.S. interfering in its affairs before the revolution and trying to rein this country in since the revolution. But whatever policy the U.S. adopts towards Iran reflects back on itself. Perhaps that is why America thinks or appears to think that Iran interfered with its 2020 elections.
In the contemporary history, the trend has been reversed for the first time. It was the Americans and Britons who decided who had to become prime minister in Iran. But now, Iran is accused of interfering with the U.S. presidential election. The claims that Iran is sending emails are untrue, but the fact is that we are influential in the U.S. election. I mean that many of those who are fighting against racism in the U.S. are inspired by the Islamic Revolution.
Now I have spoken for reason for Iranian suspicion towards America. The Iranians, with their long history, are tolerant and understanding of political turbulence. But the Iraq-Iran war and how the U.S. aided and abetted the aggressor Saddam Hussein against Iran are cause for hatred even.
Rivalry and even conflict between Iran and the U.S. may lie under the same opposition to a political interpretation of Islam. In the other words, since before the end of Second World War, we saw Islamist tendencies with political approaches in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. We see it even during the constitutional revolution in Iran, Sayyid Jamal Asadabadi. A sort of return to self or religious revisionism was crystallized in the Islamic Revolution, and Imam Khomeini symbolized protests against the political, economic, and social system.
U.S. aggression aside, the lack of affinity between the two states is actually natural, going by the nature of Iran's political constitution post-revolution. This can be summarized in one aspect as follows. Iran's effort to become a free independent state based on the Republic and Islam versus U.S. attempts to return Iran to being a country serving the West in any way possible.
We face with the reality. The U.S. does not like Iran as it is now. The U.S. expects fundamental changes in Iran in order to allay its pressure. Mr. Pompeo has said on several occasions that Iran should become a normal nation. What they mean is something similar to pre-revolution Iran or some regional nations. Due to such problems, Iran's efforts to allay pressure have failed.
And as long as it deems necessary, Iran just won't say yes to no resistance. After years of U.S. sanctions, interference, and espionage. In fact, the room behind me is where U.S. diplomats held their secret meetings. Talking of sanctions,
Sanctions have in fact made Iranian rulership's rhetoric more decisive. They are now talking of industrial independence, not just from the West, but also from Iran's own oil economy.
The economic blow that Iran suffered through the oil embargo, among other things, showed the Iranian authorities more and more that they must free the country's economy from dependence on one type of income. Iran once showed in facing Obama's sanctions that it can withstand such restrictions. On the other hand, Iran's self-reliance with this process can become a model for other countries.
The US pressure campaign has not been successful. The Iranian economy has not collapsed. Iran's regional and defense policies have not changed. Iran's JCPOA approach has not changed either. Iran has even distanced itself from hazardous nucleus materials. But the Trump administration thinks differently, and its aides say the pressure campaign against Iran has been successful, and Iran is on the cusp of change.
Iran's resistance caused an awakening among other regional states, and this turned into an axis of resistance.
Bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Decision 2020. Educational institutions in the U.S. were supposed to represent equality of opportunity, but there are still persisting inequalities at the heart of America's educational system. Hundreds of thousands of American students have been exposed to gun violence during school hours, and there's been a large number of deadly shooting incidents at American schools. Experts have also labeled the issue of student debt. That's a big problem. It's called a national crisis at this point, which is dragging down the economy, fueling the racial wealth gap, and even destroying lives. Then teachers, they're frustrated. Although their job comes with unique challenges, the majority of them earn a solid middle-class wage at best. Hello, and welcome to Decision 2020. I'm Kavit Ahmed. Yet, unfortunately, the topic we've covered in this program, like the U.S. educational system, is not the one being covered by mainstream candidates.
In the United States, the school system is viewed as an educational ladder, a concept used by the Americans to reflect the value of individual success and the equal opportunity for working one's way to the top. However, although the Civil Rights Acts of the mid-1960s eventually ended, the legality of the infamous practice of school segregation and educational inequality in the U.S., students still receive dramatically different learning opportunities based on their social status. In many areas, the cost of education is rising much more rapidly than the average family income is. There are striking differences between white and non-white students' access to key educational resources, including skilled teachers, quality curriculum, sufficient funding, and essential classroom materials. Schools receive a large percentage of their money from local property taxes. As a result, the wealthier school districts offer better educational opportunities. Recent reports show that predominantly white school districts receive nearly $23 billion more in funding than other non-white school districts, despite serving roughly the same number of students. This shows that racial gaps in residential patterns are directly linked to educational disparities in the U.S.
A series of university research in the year 2019 surprisingly showed that New York schools are the most segregated in the U.S. That revealed that they not only isolated students by race, but also by their socioeconomic status. Let's hear more about that.
we have such a disparity between schools that largely serve black and Latino populations and then the small number of schools that white parents tend to send their children to. And so I've been covering school segregation for a long time, but then had my own child who was 4 years old, and I was having to suddenly pick a school for her in this very segregated system.
Even if these schools were roughly equivalent academically, as that would still be a violation of the principle of Brown versus Board of Education that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. But in practice, they are very rarely equal in any way. Black and Latino children are more likely to attend schools with inexperienced teachers, which are then less likely to offer a college prep curriculum. On top of which, because race and class are inextricably linked, those students are six times as likely to be in high poverty schools. And while there are teachers and students working incredibly hard in those places, they are often doing so with fewer resources.
Okay, I mean, talking about this in the year 2020 is quite incredible. All right, Nicole Hannah-Jones, author of New York Times Magazine article, Choosing a School for My Daughter, is what you heard there, along with John Oliver, just courtesy of them, in order to bring the point across. Well, having heard that, let's get our first guest in and hear the guest's opinion about the ongoing racism crisis that's happening at U.S. schools and the potential political solutions for this problem. James Brewer is an assistant professor of social foundations of education at the University of North Georgia with expertise in education policy surrounding issues of public schools, the privatization of schools, and issues of equity and justice. Hello, Jameson. Welcome to Decision 2020. First question, the U.S. has a clear two-pronged approach when it comes to schooling, with white middle classes being at a clear advantage compared to the black lower classes. How do you think that this should be addressed when it comes to each of the mainstream candidates?
I think that it's clear that the United States has a historical equity issue when it comes to racial justice across our society, but especially in our schools. Something that we learned just last year that we've always known intuitively is that schools that dominantly serve white students receive approximately an additional $23 billion in funding per year. Now, of course, the significant portion of that difference is because the way that we fund schools is heavily dependent on property taxes here in the United States.
Wow, interesting point that he makes there. We appreciate that, James Brewer. He talked about equity issue and how white students are receiving, the schools that is, $20 billion more when it comes to their budget in terms of property taxes, perhaps. And of course, that is a clear disadvantage for the schools that have people of color in it. Well, when we take a look at the way that this situation is evolving in the U.S., keeping the schools safe is another challenge that U.S. administrations have been facing amid a steady rise in school shootings all across the country in the past decades.
Research shows that a majority of American teenagers are worried about the possibility of a shooting happening at their schools. Many students and parents are outraged by what they refer to as gross incompetence on part of school and law enforcement officials. They have repeatedly called for gun legislation and further school safety measures, but different U.S. administrations, whether Republican or Democrat, have flip-flopped on their pledges for new gun control laws. Although some state legislators have passed several gun control regulations in recent years, the National Rifle Association continues to press lawmakers to prioritize the interests of gun owners across the U.S. That shows that the fate of hundreds of thousands of innocent children lies in the hands of one of the most powerful lobby groups in the U.S., the foremost defender of the country's controversial Second Amendment of the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Anxiety over potential school shootings has created a common fear among Americans, and many people persistently use any platform that they have to express their anger towards these senseless tragedies. Okay, back to our guest, James Brewer, professor of social foundations of education, UNG, to talk about this violent practice and its consequences for the U.S. education system. James Brewer, welcome back. Gun crime and mass shootings is a major issue in schools in the U.S. Having seen multiple occasions where atrocities have been committed on school grounds, how do you think education can actually play a part in ending gun crime?
think that it's also clear that the United States has a gun violence problem. I think that we have in this country approximately 2 to 3 guns for every person in our country. So I think that the answer to the question, I think that schools can play a part. I think that clearly teachers and educators and administrators and counselors think that they can, and historically they always have been, and you can continue to serve students and serve community needs and provide resources for students who are hurting, provide resources to communities and the broader society. But I think that the answer to the question, I think it has to come from a broad societal sort of examination of how this country approaches particularly gun ownership, but also the mass expansion of gun ownership over the past few decades, because I think that teachers and educators can play a part, but I think it'd be very difficult for teachers and schools by themselves to fix what is in effect a societal issue.
Okay, thank you very much. That is James Brewer, Professor of Social Foundations of Education at UNG, with his comments on that. But, I mean, he makes a lot of good suggestions, granted, but how can the U.S. president, who's saying that Democrat-run cities are the ones that are suffering from crime, if he's segregating it into those two categories, red and blue states, do you think there's going to be any solutions?
The U.S. economy largely relies on its vast infrastructure network. These systems were built decades ago and they suffer from comparatively low quality. Experts are warned about safety concerns, and the American Society of Civil Engineering has given the U.S. infrastructure a low grade. Daily inconveniences for longer commutes, structural deficiency for bridges, antiquated drinking water, internet provision, wastewater systems, and air transportation all need upgrades and observations. That is while other developed countries enjoy more reliable and efficient services. Meanwhile, different polls show that the majority of American people and businesses support rebuilding the infrastructure. So why is the U.S. lagging behind its international peers such as France, Germany, and Japan in infrastructure? These discrepancies can be traced back to very different funding levels, either through tax, tolls, or private investment.
It seems that the U.S. infrastructure is in a dire state. Let's hear more about this.
We have 16 categories of infrastructure. We put together a pool of experts, about 30 different civil engineers who are analyzing. A lot of it is data that's available through the federal government. So we're looking at aviation, bridges, roads, transit, dams, levees, schools, parks, solid waste, drinking water, wastewater. So all of these different categories are analyzed. Unfortunately, 12 out of the 16 categories are in the D range, which is poor or at risk, which is really reflecting a lot of our infrastructure being at the end of its useful life.
More stimulus is needed. I mean, the two problems the economy faces, the two big headwinds are, number one, obviously the pandemic, and we're not going to see the economy fully recover until the pandemic is totally contained. But the other is we've got to have adequate money in people's pockets. We've got to have a stimulus that enables people to spend. And obviously, if people don't have enough money to spend, they're not going to be able to get the economy moving. The multiplier effect that comes from the bottom 80% of this economy's spending is really what this economy fundamentally depends on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's very alarming when you take a look at how, in that report by the engineers for the U.S. in terms of infrastructure as a whole, that you have actually drinking water in the D range. 4 out of the 6 categories is in D range. Well, let's bring in our guests to see what the main economic challenges are that the U.S. Is facing in terms of its infrastructure. We're going to bring in William K. Black, Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. William, it's great to have you with us. The U.S. infrastructure is crumbling. I'm sure you'll agree with that. You have roads, rail, and various hubs that are underfunded. How can the U.S. come up with the money to build this up? I mean, some estimates have, for example, stated that billions of dollars are needed and years of work to restore the U.S. water supply, which got a D, by the way, to acceptable standards. That's just one example.
Right. There are huge numbers of productive investments that the United States could make. It's not that everything is crumbling, but Certainly, we're a major contributor to global climate disruption, and certainly there are many productive things we could do to improve things like the safety of dams and bridges. Indeed, about 6 miles from where I'm giving this interview, a major bridge across the Mississippi River famously fell into the river and killed several people. And so this is a win-win, and the answer to your question directly on funding is the United States, of course, is a nation with a sovereign currency that can borrow or simply issue money in its own currency, even without directly borrowing. So this is modern monetary theory. The problem is not cash. The problem is political willingness. Indeed, it's an inside joke in the United States whenever you say infrastructure week is coming, because President Trump has been, you know, promising for 4 years now that next week he's going to do infrastructure, which would be have great bipartisan support, and of course he's never actually done it.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to get back to you. I mean, talk about what he has said, political willingness. I mean, he just mentioned that there was a dam that was that fell apart and killed several people. You have drinking water, again, that had to derange, and people are getting sick off of that. Different states have actually cited that. So we'll see how this is going to pan out. As we already discussed, there seems to be a general consensus on the need for more resources for rebuilding the U.S. infrastructure. What is exactly standing in the way then?
Experts say the U.S. infrastructure faces a funding gap of more than $2 trillion needed by 2025. The intimidating specter raises the question of resources for financing the U.S. infrastructure needs. Many call for increased federal spending and a federal infrastructure bank to generate revenue and offer institutional investment to development projects. However, unlike the European countries that receive the major part of their infrastructure development funding from the national level, the U.S. federal government only provides 25% of the country's needed funding for development. Consequently, many argue that the presence of the private sector is essential. Those who are skeptical of federal government spending say the existence of a public-private partnership would be more efficient and cost-effective. Infrastructure is also critical to the employment rates in the U.S. These show that there is a need for a data-driven approach towards infrastructure funding rather than a politically driven one.
Okay, William, when we look at the impact of the COVID-19 virus hitting certain infrastructures more than others, maybe not directly, where should each candidate then be focusing his or her attention, in this case, his attention, when it comes to truly rebuilding America and making it great again?
COVID hasn't directly attacked infrastructure in the sense of destroying infrastructure, but it certainly has made it more difficult to do things like improve infrastructure by having construction projects that would be inside. And there hasn't been any political will on the part of the Republican majority leader in the Senate to do big infrastructure programs. And so we are in an unusual circumstance politically in which President Trump wants a large bill, including some infrastructure, and where the Democrats want it, but Mitch McConnell controls the Senate as majority leader and is, at least at this juncture, saying that he wants no legislation before the U.S. election, which is, in under 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you very much. William K. Black, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, talking to us there. He did fail to mention about the fact that you still have this almost $3 trillion stimulus package for COVID-19, people who are suffering from it. Add to that the large infrastructure bill that Trump has proposed. How are they going to get to that? They can't even agree on it, so it's a bipartisan issue. And that does it for this edition of the program. I'm Kovetak Lee. It's goodbye for now.
your thought.
Being here at Mass Ikna has become something of a pleasurable tradition for me. I first participated in the Interfaith Symposium in its inaugural year in 2015, and this is my third time visiting with you. I'm grateful to the convener of the Interfaith Symposium, Karen Danielson, for her long-standing friendship, and over the last 4 years, I have participated in events across Chicago at the Mosque Foundation and at the Universal High School. She and her colleagues have visited my synagogue. Some of these interfaith events we shared with other speakers today. So I'm happy to be with all of you today. So my comments today are in two parts. First, I talk about my relationship as a rabbi and a Jew to Muslims and Palestinians. Second, I point to a pressing concern I have about Jewish-Christian interfaith. Now, there are rabbis whose job it is to do interfaith. They have advanced degrees in the subject. Interfaith is in their job description. It's on their business cards. I am not one of them. The reason why I am here and not them is because of the positions I have taken on Palestine in distinction to theirs. In particular, unlike some of my colleagues, I would never demand that Muslims refrain from speaking their minds and their hearts on Israel-Palestine as a prerequisite for interfaith dialogue with me. I am a rabbi, and I wholeheartedly endorse BDS, the three-part Palestinian call for justice and equality. I say yes to BDS in the first place because it is what the Palestinians have asked of us. I say yes to BDS because until Palestinians are free, neither will the Jews be free. And I'm here to tell you that along with Jewish Voice for Peace, not all Jews support the State of Israel's persecution of Palestinians, and the views I hold are held by hundreds of thousands of other Jews. Now, when you turn outward, away from your religious group, you inevitably turn your back on some of your own, or so some people will feel. And these people may act on their feelings. And as my esteemed interfaith colleagues in the earlier session know, building bridges to other faiths and ethnic or racial groups can mean burning bridges within the faith, losing friends, and even straining family relations. I know. I have experienced all of that. The walls around each of our religions are designed in part to keep them out and us in. And discovering that the best of Jewish values are also Christian and Muslim can be threatening to some people's identity. But my experience teaches me that the rewards of reaching out surpass the risk and the cost. First and foremost, there is the joy and freedom of speaking one's hopes and aspirations honestly and living in alignment with the call for justice. Secondly, for every friend I have lost in the Jewish community, I have made wonderful new friends in other communities such as here, and indeed new friends in the Jewish community. Let me tell you a little bit about my family history as it informs my interfaith work. Over a century ago, my paternal grandfather was orphaned in a white supremacist massacre against Jews in his native Ukraine. 80 years ago, my mother lost her parents when the Nazi state murdered them and 6 million other people for the crime of being born Jews. And in both cases, non-Jews were instrumental in saving their lives. My mother's life was saved through a remarkable operation, a collaboration between Jews and Quakers in my native England. And now while I carry my grandfather and mother's experience with me, I am blessed that my own political reality is so different to what they experienced as children. After all, I am a white middle-class Jew in America. And so in previous years, I attended Mass Ikna to stand in solidarity with the religious community whose political reality is closer to that of my grandparents than my own, a community with many first-generation immigrants who are targeted by the government and others on account of their skin color, race, or religion. This year, however, is different. Yes, I am here in solidarity, but this year, I have skin in the game too, Jewish skin. You see, in the past year of 2019, something fundamental changed for me. Interfaith has become more complicated and at the same time more urgent. Interfaith is such a compelling idea in no small part because of the perception in society that religion is divisive. In response, interfaith makes the bold claim that our particular religious traditions need not drive us apart, but actually draw us closer to each other. We must scale the world's walls around our own religions to build bridges with others. And when we cross those bridges, we need to have honest conversation and ask open-ended questions with an open heart and truly address our concerns to bring ourselves to the conversation. Pittsburgh, Poway, Jersey City. Friends, 2019 brought the unwelcome, unprecedented phenomenon of the periodic murder of Jews in America every few months. It exposed the ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism, not just in areas where hatred of minorities is perhaps commonplace, but also in genteel suburbia and the big cities. And as we come to the end of 2019, the good intentions and positivity of past interfaith gatherings will no longer suffice. After years of building goodwill and collaborating in so many beautiful ways, the time has come in this relationship to risk some honesty. And this is my honest talk. The conversations at Jewish Hanukkah celebrations this year turned to how safe it is to publicly identify as a Jew. A few years ago, such fears would have been deemed irrational. Not anymore. And as a Jew, I am afraid. And as a Jew, I know what it is to be in the religious majority. I have had that experience. I was an Israeli Jew for 20 years. I grew up in a country where Jewish concerns were self-evident and those of others were not well represented. I grew up in a country where the evidence of the Nakba was all around me, but there was no narrative, no awareness for the majority Jews to make moral or emotional sense of it. And so, the Palestinian past was a ghost, and the Palestinian present was irrelevant or a threat. It was only when I came here and joined the American Jewish community that I saw the fundamental injustice of the Israeli system with regard to the Palestinians. Only when I became a religious minority in a Christian majority country was I able to see Israel in perspective. Some of you who came from Muslim majority countries and are now a religious minority as American Muslims may have had a similar reassessment of how you see your home countries. So where does the interfaith community go from here? The bottom line is that even as interfaith relations are so important, I can no longer engage in them with blind trust in the goodwill of my counterparts. Back in April 2019, a religious man prayed hateful words on Good Friday. A week later, he took the life of a Jew in synagogue on a holy day as she prayed to God. The murderer said, "I learned that it was right to kill Jews in church." Not that his church or any church preached violence against Jews, far from it. But words do matter. What we say in our houses of worship at elevated moments of emotion, on sacred days and in deep moments of prayer, truly matter. Words are the stuff of religion, holy writ, scripture, liturgy, prayer, sermon, and we need to get it right. So, henceforth, I will ask my interfaith partners, when you pray, how do you speak of the Jews? And perhaps I have now come to the same place as the organizers of this wonderful interfaith symposium. Namely, not all interfaith partners are equally welcome. There have to be some basic standards for engagement. So going forward, I will ask direct questions and listen carefully to the answers. Perhaps that is what it means to be Jewish. Perhaps that is what it means to be a religious minority. Thank you.
www.parstoday.com/en